From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from Seattle, Washington.
There was one question that was voted on that ranked fairly high, and that was whether legalizing marijuana would improve the economy and job creation. I don't think that is a good strategy to grow our economy. So, all right.
President Obama laughs off a question about the legalization of marijuana during his internet town hall. We'll speak with Norm Stamper. Yes, he was the police chief a decade ago during the Battle of Seattle. He also served on the front lines of the so-called war on drugs for many years. He now supports legalization. Then, Sustainable Seattle. We'll be joined by one of the leading voices of the movement to build sustainable cities and reducing waste. He's the president of the Seattle City Council. And with the recession deepening, we'll take a look at how the economic crisis impacts your health. But first, with homelessness on the rise, more and more people across the country are living in tent cities. We'll speak with a resident of Nicholsville, Seattle's newest tent city. It's named for the mayor. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Spanish court has launched a criminal investigation into whether six Bush administration lawyers, including former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, violated international law by providing the legal framework to justify the Bush administration's use of torture at Guantanamo. Spain's law allows it to claim jurisdiction in the case because five Spanish citizens or residents who were prisoners at Guantanamo say they were tortured there. The case was sent to the Spanish prosecutor's office for review by Baltasar Garzón, the Spanish judge who ordered the arrest of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet in 1998. The other former Bush administration officials facing investigation are former Justice Department officials John Yoo and Jay Bybee, Pentagon official Douglas Feith, Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, David Addington, and Pentagon lawyer William Haynes. Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights praised the Spanish court's decision and said arrest warrants might have already been issued.
If you're any of those six at this point, you don't want to go to the 25 countries that make up the European Union because you may be subject to immediate arrest. What will happen next is this investigation will most likely continue in a very vigorous form. It will look at those six, and it also has the possibility of going up the chain of command, not just to Rumsfeld, but all the way up to Cheney and Bush. So it's a serious investigation. It's one that the Obama administration has to take very seriously. And it means for them that the pressure is increasing, really, in this country to open its own criminal investigation.
Michael Ratner is author of The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld. Meanwhile, former senior government officials have told The Washington Post the CIA's decision to waterboard and torture their first high-value captive, Abu Zubaydah, produced little intelligence. The officials said not a single significant plot was foiled as a result of Abu Zubaydah's tortured confessions. Most of the useful information gained from him was obtained before waterboarding was introduced. In Pakistan, gunners seized a police training academy in Lahore and killed as many as 40 police officers before Pakistani officials were able to retake the building after an 8-hour siege. As many as 80 officers were injured. The Pakistani newspaper Dawn said militants attacked the police academy with machine guns and grenades. 850 young cadets were inside the building when the assault began. The attack came 2 days after President Obama defended his decision to send 21,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan and to increase aid to Pakistan. Obama said his one goal is to wipe out al-Qaeda militants, whom he said were plotting new attacks on the United States.
The world cannot afford the price that will come due if Afghanistan slides back into chaos or al-Qaeda operates unchecked. We have a shared responsibility to act, not because we seek to project power for its own sake, but because our own peace and security depends on it. And what's at stake at this time is not just our own security, it's the very idea that free nations can come together on behalf of our common security.
The New York Times reports the Obama administration was divided over what to do in Afghanistan. The commanders in the field wanted a large surge of troops, but Vice President Joseph Biden reportedly warned against getting into a political and military quagmire. In business news, General Motors chair and CEO Rick Wagner has stepped down after he was asked to resign by the Obama administration as part of the government's demand for GM and Chrysler to restructure before receiving more federal aid money. President Obama is scheduled to unveil his full plan for the auto industry today. The McClatchy newspapers reports Obama will reject requests for almost $22 billion in new taxpayer bailout money for GM and Chrysler, saying the car makers have failed to take steps to ensure their viability. The government sought the departure of the GM chief and said the company needed to be widely restructured if it had any hope of survival. The government's expected to provide the company with 60 days operating capital to give it time to undertake reforms. The government will also grant Chrysler 30 days operating funds, but said it must merge with the Italian carmaker Fiat in order to remain viable. So far, GM and Chrysler have received $17.4 billion in government rescue money, a fraction of what the government has given to help revive the banking industry. New employment figures show Michigan still has the nation's highest unemployment rate at least 12%. In February, the employment rate jumped into double figures in Nevada, North Carolina, and Oregon. The jobless rate is also above 10% in California, South Carolina, and Rhode Island. At least 35,000 protesters marched in London on Saturday to kick off a series of demonstrations leading up to the G20 summit. Protest organizers said the turnout was three times larger than expected. Protest organizer Chris Knights with the group G20 Meltdown said the demonstrations will focus on the bankers who wrecked the economy.
The main message to them really is you are financial fools. You are the architects of this catastrophe, but with the exception of Barack Obama, of course, who has to make a choice which side he's on still. But those fools, what makes them feel that they are the people qualifying to sort out the mess? And if you ask me what do we want from them, I would say it's quite a lot, actually. We want the Earth. Give us back our planet. We want it. You've got it. We're going to take it. And you should be good-humoured about it. You are incompetent idiots who've messed everything up, and you should step aside and let the people take over.
The protest against the G20 is expected to be the largest anti-capitalist demonstration in London in years.
We say that unless the leaders of the world break from capitalism, unless there's a change in the whole attitude towards climate change and towards poverty, towards the problem in the world, then there's no chance of resolving these problems. We need a socialist alternative.
Large demonstrations are also expected this week in France and Germany during the NATO summit in the French city of Strasbourg. In news from Asia, North Korea says it'll launch a communications satellite as early as Saturday, but Japan and other nations have accused North Korea of secretly testing an intercontinental ballistic missile. On Sunday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the U.S. has no plans to shoot down the missile.
I think if we had an aberrant missile, one that was headed for Hawaii, that looked like it was headed for Hawaii or something like that, we might consider it. But I don't think we have any plans to do anything like that at this point.
A team of Canadian researchers have uncovered a vast electronic spy network that infiltrated the offices of the Dalai Lama, the Asian Development Bank, the Associated Press, and many foreign embassies. Researchers link the spy operation to servers in China, but caution there's no direct evidence implicating the Chinese government. Intelligence analysts say many governments, including those of China, Russia, and the United States, use sophisticated computer programs to covertly gather information. The spy network, known as GhostNet, infiltrated nearly 1,300 computers in 100 countries. Once a computer is infected with the spy spies gained the ability to turn on the camera and audio recording functions of the computer, enabling monitors to see and hear what goes on in a room. The spy network also gained control of mail servers for the Dalai Lama's offices, allowing the spies to intercept all correspondence. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets on Friday at a crowd of Palestinians protesting the construction of the separation wall in the town of Bilin. Reuters video showed an Israeli soldier shooting a Palestinian demonstrator with a rubber-coated bullet at point-blank range, injuring his leg. Palestinian legislator Mustafa Barghouti attended the demonstration and said the new Israeli government will further damage the lives of Palestinians.
The only thing that the new Israeli government is bringing is more settlement, more land confiscation, more discrimination, more apartheid, and more building of this wall that is killing the lives of the Palestinians and destroying the option of peace based on two-state solution.
The company of Motorola is a target of a new boycott campaign organized by the group New York Campaign for Boycott of Israel. Organizer Rivka Bar-Zohar accused Motorola of supporting Israel's military occupation.
Motorola produces bomb fuses, communications devices, surveillance technology that's used directly by the Israeli military in its ongoing occupation of the Palestinian people.
In North Carolina, eight people died Sunday after a gunman opened fire at a nursing home in the town of Carthage. Seven elderly patients died, as well as a nurse. The Raleigh News and Observer reported the gunman's estranged wife was working at the nursing home at the time of the attack, but was not listed as a victim. And the union activist and folklorist Archie Greene has died at the age of 91. The New York Times said Greene single-handedly persuaded Congress to create the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. For decades, he studied what he called labor lore, the work songs, slang, craft techniques, and tales that helped to define the trade unions. 2 years ago, he published The Big Red Songbook, a collection of lyrics to more than 250 songs written by the industrial workers of the world, best known as the Wobblies. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Seattle. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington State. Juan Gonzalez is in New York.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. And greetings to you, Amy. And how's it going on the first leg of your month-long tour?
Well, it looks like we're going to be visiting about 70 cities. We began here in Seattle yesterday at the Green Fest. These green festivals are cropping up around the nation. They'll be in Denver and Chicago and San Francisco. We started here and then went up to Olympia to the Capitol Theater. And we're also celebrating community media around the country. Overall, it's Pacifica Radio's 60th anniversary. So we'll be in San Francisco and Berkeley on April 15th, which is the day Pacifica went on the air, the first station, KPFA. We celebrated last night, TCTV, which is Thurston County Television. It's public access TV and Chaos Radio. Then today we head to Washington, D.C., and I'll be at Georgetown with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh. We'll be talking about journalism in this time of war and an economic meltdown. And then tomorrow I head to Ithaca, New York, and I'll be there with Glenn Greenwald, the blogger with Salon.com. Then I'll head back to New York. I'll be with you, Juan, in New York on Wednesday. Thursday, we head off to Cambridge, Massachusetts. On Friday, we'll be in Amherst, Northampton, South Hadley area, and we'll be celebrating a longtime activist who is celebrating her 90th birthday, Frances Crowe, with Media Education Foundation. Then it's on to Middletown Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, then to Kansas City. We'll be celebrating KKFI, and then on to Tampa, Florida, to the wonderful community radio station WMNF, and we'll be broadcasting from PBS in Tampa for 2 days. Tampa is where Wikipedia is based. We'll be broadcasting from WeDo, from WDU's studios there. And then we head on from there. So if people want to see the tours, we travel through Montana, Idaho, Tennessee, Florida. We will—you can go to our website at democracynow.org.
Well, with all those frequent flyer miles you're piling up, maybe we can raffle some of them off at the next fundraiser. As the nation's economic and housing crisis worsens, homelessness is also on the rise. A report from the National Center for Family Homelessness estimates that 1 in 50 American children are now homeless, with the number of homeless people far exceeding the existing network of shelters. An increasing number of people are setting up roving encampments or shanty towns that are popularly known as tent cities.
And right here in Seattle, tent cities have been around since the late 90s, have also served as centers for organizing around affordable housing and services for the homeless. Seattle's newest tent city is called Nicholsville. The encampment is made up of over 100 pink tents and is named to protest the mayor, Greg Nickels' policies around the homeless. I'm joined here in Seattle by two people, Bruce Beavers, who lives in Nicholsville, and Anitra Freeman. She is formerly homeless. She is with homeless organizing groups in Seattle. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Bruce, when did you start living at Nicholsville? And why name it for the mayor?
Well, I started living in Nicholsville on September the 25th. Why we named it Nicholsville after the mayor, because the mayor actually single-handedly have actually, he didn't start homelessness, but he's actually single-handedly trying to drive homelessness out of Seattle.
In what way?
Well, he have continuously to disrupt Nicholsville. He have thrown us off a piece of property that we actually found that would have been just perfect for Nicholsville to actually build their houses and sustain a nice place to live. He actually drove us off. He arrested 25 people. He continuously to threaten our host of giving us any kind of help at all. So he's really just been a sort for
Anitra.
He's harassing all of the encampments. There are thousands of people who are outside. The shelters have been inadequate for years. There's never been enough shelter for everybody. There are thousands of people outside, people camping, and instead of helping the people who are trying to survive outside, Nickels single-handedly started a program of harassing them, of chasing people out of encampments and actually destroying their camping gear. And he set up one showcase shelter for 50 people that costs $500 million, $500,000 a year. And while this network of self-managed shelters that the homeless organizing group does can shelter 500 people a night for the same amount of money.
My colleague in New York, Juan Gonzalez, wants to ask you a question. Juan?
Yes. Bruce Beavers, if you could share with our audience what happened with you in your particular situation that you ended up homeless and how you got involved more as an activist.
Well, I used to, from 95 to 2005, I actually worked at a company called Acme Food Sales. It's an import-export company of canned goods. It's right here in Seattle off First Avenue. I was there for quite a while. I became the warehouse manager there. Once me and Acme kind of broke up and went our separate ways, that was a big salary I had. I tried to actually come with the salary by working at Dollar Tree, assistant manager at Dollar Tree, in Federal Way, for about a year. And that didn't make the money, and I went to McLennan Hardware. My bills was constantly adding up. My house wound up going into foreclosure. I bought it in 2003. So by 2007, all my bills was coming so far over my head I couldn't afford it. And by 2008, I actually lost the house and everything else. I met a young lady, and she actually talked about going to Nicholsville. And we actually went to Nicholsville. And Nicholsville actually saved my life, actually. It took us off the street because we were sleeping in alleyways, anywhere we could sleep, waterfronts. We would be woken up at 2-3 o'clock in the morning and say we couldn't sleep there. You know, we getting soaking wet. It was cold. Nicholsville actually gave us a pink tent. It was a pink tent. And from there, we kind of realized that Nicholsville was a lifesaver. It saved our life. And we have been involved in Nicholsville ever since.
And Anita Freeman, I'd like to ask you, my understanding is that Nicholsville has had several locations as it's been harassed, and it ended up, we're in a church parking lot at present time?
Yes. Churches have a lot more freedom to host tent cities in places like Nicholsville because there's legally a very limited amount of authority that the government has over what the church does with their property. They can ask for, you know, minimum for the least intrusive possible health and safety requirements, and otherwise they've got to keep their hands off. So churches find it very easy to host the tent cities, whereas private citizens are much more vulnerable to harassment.
Do you feel like the situation is getting much worse here in Seattle?
Oh, it is, definitely. But, you know, there have been great amounts of homeless people for at least 20 years. People have been dying on the street for 20 years. The homeless women's group that I work with stands a vigil, Women in Black, whenever somebody homeless dies outside or by violence in King County. We started in 2000 and we stood vigil for 330 people since then, 11 just this year. This has been going on for a long time. And it is getting worse.
And what do you see, Anita Freeman, as the advantages of these tent cities versus the established city-run shelters that exist not only in Seattle, but many parts of the country?
Well, the main thing is there's not enough shelter. There are people outside. The tent cities and Nicholsville allow people to come together and support each other, and they're much safer in a group. They can organize more resources, and they, you know, Bruce can tell you, you have a space of your own. You can leave your things behind, not carry them around all day. You can be with your family, with your couple. You can actually have a community and things that you can do to contribute. It's a greater amount of human dignity for people, and basically you have a porta potty, and you have dumpsters, and you have survival, much better survival chances than you do out there alone.
Do you see yourself finally, Bruce, getting a home at some point soon?
Yes. Like I said, Nicholsville is a place where people that have been up in the world and had something, once you lose something, you know, Nicholsville catches you in between. It doesn't let you go all the way down. Like, I had to come from up. Most folks that's losing their places now can come to a place like Nicholsville and leave their stuff, like she was saying. They, you can go out and live a normal life. You can interact in the neighborhood. You can interact with your jobs. You know, you can take showers. You get your self-esteem back. Me and my wife now, we're actually saving. Nicholsville is giving us the opportunity to get back on our feet. Even once I leave Nicholsville, if never, I will actually still be a Nickelodeon. I would still participate in what Nicholsville have to do.
Well, Bruce,
over the years, I've seen much higher rate of people getting back on their feet out of the tent cities than out of the shelters.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Anita Freeman was homeless, continues to be a homeless activist, and Bruce Beavers currently lives in Nicholsville. As you hear, they are called Nickelodeons. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back from break, as we continue here in Seattle, we'll speak with one of the leading voices for the movement to build sustainable cities. He's the president of the Seattle City Council, Richard Conlon. We're then going to be speaking with the former police chief of Seattle, Norm Stamper. He's one of the leading voices for decriminalization, for legalization of marijuana. And we'll be talking about health care. We'll be speaking with a UW professor, University of Washington and Seattle professor, about the inequities in health care today as the economy melts down. Stay with us.
Has been stolen, I ain't lying down. I'm going to spit it all around. I don't want to be the meek one, sit back and bite my tongue. I dare somebody to tell me not to sing that song. These are some big words that we all learned in school. The words to build a country by or give notice to a fool. I took the liberty to rhyme them all the easier to sing. Maybe it'll help to make the pendulum swing. Cause this is my declaration. It's your declaration too. So let's live up to it. See what we can do. Yeah, let's go see what we can do. And that means that everyone can see that we are all created equal. And that means that you are just like me, with certain unalienable rights. And that means that they are ours to keep, like life, liberty, and happiness. Well, don't it make you want to weep? We institute our governments. They get their powers from us. They govern by our consent. And should any one of them become destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish them. This is my declaration.
And you've been listening to Jim Page. He is a local area artist, well-known on Democracy Now!, singing the Declaration song. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in Seattle on our community media Standing Up to the Madness tour, Juan Gonzalez in New York. And sitting next to me today is Richard Conlon. He's the president of the Seattle City Council, co-founder of the organization Sustainable Seattle. 2 years ago, Richard Conlon launched the Zero Waste strategy to improve the city's recycling rate and advocated a 20-cent fee on disposable shopping bags that was passed by the city council. But the plastics industry and the Washington food industry launched a petition drive against the ordinance, and the issue is expected to be placed on the ballot for a public vote later this year. Well, today, as Seattle launches a new composting program to further improve its waste management, Richard Conlon, we welcome you to Democracy Now! To make the announcement of today's program that's beginning in Seattle.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Talk about this program that starts today.
Well, we've actually been doing food waste composting for a while in the city, but today we inaugurate a universal collection for all single-family households, and all food waste can be put into it. It's going to be moving from a biweekly to a weekly model. We're expanding from the 60,000 households who formerly participated to about 100,000 households participating today. We expect this to be a huge step forward in the zero waste strategy.
How does it work?
Essentially, everybody gets a cart. You can get different sizes of carts depending on what you're going to be producing in your household, and then the cart is picked up on a weekly basis. You can place all food and all food-related items into it. The food then gets taken off to a composting facility, and it becomes great soil.
Talk about the situation for renewable, for composting, for environmental policy in Seattle.
Well, Seattle has a great group of citizens who are really committed to the environment, and we've been working for a long time to try and improve a lot of different things about the way in which we deal with environmental issues and into the concept of sustainability, which brings environment, economy, social justice, and community together. So this is simply one step in making that happen. The Zero Waste strategy is designed to really take the next step beyond recycling. Lots of people recycle. What we're talking about is waste reduction and moving to the next stage where we actually reduce the amount of waste that's sent away to the landfills.
And Richard Conlon, what happened with the plastic bag initiative, the 20-cent tax, and how was that beaten back?
Well, first of all, it's not a tax, it's a fee. It's an advanced disposal fee. So what happens is that when a person gets a bag at a store, they are charged a fee by the store, and then that store goes into the solid waste fund and is used for recycling programs. That was voted by the council and approved last year. And then the plastics industry came in, and they put $200,000 into a signature gathering drive. It's the most astonishing initiative initiative drive I've seen. They paid $15 per signature, but they were able to get it and put it on the ballot. We have this is a progressive era state, and so the people have the right to vote on these things, and we will be putting it on the ballot this August, actually.
And where does go ahead, Juan?
In terms of the total amount of waste that Seattle produces, is it like many cities export its garbage to landfills or even out of state?
We actually send our garbage to a landfill in eastern Oregon, and every day we send a mile-long train of garbage out of Seattle to that landfill in eastern Oregon. It's really an astonishing thing to have to deal with.
And can you talk about how Seattle's become the first city in King County to mandate food and yard waste, to mandate the whole service that you have?
Well, we've been working on this for a long time, but we really had a tremendous spirit in our public that told us that we needed to do something a little bit more. We started recycling, curbside recycling, back in the early 1990s, late 80s. And what happened was that as we were looking at redoing our transfer station system, we had a proposal to add a third transfer station to the two transfer stations we have. And we looked at that and we said, why are we building new ways to dispose of garbage when what we ought to be doing is finding ways in which to reduce the amount of garbage? So instead of building that third transfer station, we created the zero waste strategy. And we put this out for to a public hearing, and we had hundreds of people show up, and basically nobody opposed it. The people of Seattle really believe that this is the direction, the kind of thing that we ought to be doing.
I'd like to ask Richard Conlon on another issue. Our previous guests were dealing with the tent city in Seattle. I'm wondering how the city council regards the developments of these tent cities. Is there any difference between the council's view and that of the mayor?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak for the mayor, but what I can say from the council's perspective is that there was an agreement negotiated with the group initially to allow the siting of a tent city. Clearly, what we're looking for is to try and bring people out of homelessness. Our goal is to find ways in which to give people jobs, get people homes, get people places to live. Given that that's a challenging goal, you always have to look at, so what are the things you do in the short term in order to make sure that people do have shelter? But the long-term goal is really clear. We don't think that anybody should have to be homeless.
Is there a permanent siting going to be for the Nicholsville? And how does the mayor feel about it being named for him?
Well, you probably have to ask the mayor that one. But I would guess he's not particularly enthusiastic about it. And I don't think there's likely to be a permanent siting for a tent city. The previous tent city does not have a permanent site. It moves on a regular basis from church lot to church lot, and sometimes in non-church areas as well. So I don't think there's a permanent site, and we really aren't aiming for that. We're aiming to try and find ways in which to help people get out of homelessness. That's really the goal.
And the overall policy of the Obama administration around renewable energy, around green jobs, how does that specifically affect Seattle?
Well, we feel like we're positioned very well to be take the lead in the next economy, because Seattle has long had a commitment to developing green jobs. We've actually made environmentally sustainable business, which was our acronym we use for it. We made that one of our five target industries for development for the last several years. And so there's going to be great chances for us to do not only things like siting the manufacture of wind turbines and facilities for production of that, solar cells, all of those kinds of things can be sited in Seattle. We've got some of those businesses here right now. The architectural and engineering firms that are around them, and many other kinds of green jobs as well. So this is a great chance for us. And as the economy changes, as we move into the next stage of this economy, it's a great way in which to bring together the environment and the economy. And we've got to get past that old dichotomy of saying that there's a conflict between them, because there isn't. The fact is that that's the only way in which we're going to have a real economy economy for the future is one that is environmentally responsible.
Well, Richard Conlon, I thank you for joining us. Richard Conlon is the president of the Seattle City Council. He's also the co-founder of the organization Sustainable Seattle, and he is on the board of Yes Magazine. This is Democracy Now! As we broadcast on the road, beginning our, well, close to 70-city tour right here in Seattle, Washington. Juan?
Well, with the Obama administration's increasing focus on drug-related violence in Mexico, calls to rethink how the U.S. has fought the so-called war on drugs are growing louder. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton acknowledged last week that, quote, what we've been doing has not worked. But advocates of legalizing and regulating marijuana were dealt a blow when President Obama laughed off their question during the president's first live internet town hall on Thursday.
There was one question that was voted on that ranked fairly high, and that was whether legalizing marijuana would improve the economy and job creation. And I don't know what this says about the online audience, but I just want, I don't want people to think that this was a fairly popular question. We want to make sure that it was answered. The answer is no, I don't think that is a good strategy to grow our economy. So, all right.
Well, my next guest knows what it's like to be on the front lines of fighting the war on drugs in this country and doesn't think marijuana is a laughing matter. Norm Stamper is a 34-year police officer who retired as Seattle's chief of police in 2000. His successor, Gil Krakowski, has just been nominated to be President Obama's drug czar. But Norm Stamper supports legalization of marijuana. He's an advisory board member of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, known as NORML. He's a speaker for the 10,000-member Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Norm Stamper is the author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. And he's joining us now via video stream, joining us from the island on which he lives. In fact, Norm Stamper, where do you live?
I live on Orcas Island, which is in the San Juan Islands in Washington State.
Well, we thank you so much for being with us. Why do you support the legalization of marijuana? It may surprise many to hear that the former police chief of Seattle, who was in charge during the Battle of Seattle, supports normalizing marijuana.
I actually support the legalization of all drugs, and in fact, the more dangerous or sinister or sensationally reported the experience of certain drugs, the greater the justification for the government as opposed to drug cartels and street traffickers to regulate that commerce. There's been more harm done by the drug war than good. We have spent $1 trillion prosecuting that war since Richard Nixon proclaimed drugs public enemy number one and declared all-out war on them. And what do we have to show for it? While rates can fluctuate, drugs are more readily available today at lower prices and higher levels of potency than ever before. So it's a colossal failure. And the only way to put these cartels out of business and to restore health and safety to our neighborhoods is to regulate that commerce as opposed to prohibiting it.
And Norm Stamper, your reaction to the comments of both Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she was in Mexico last week and of President Obama?
Well, quoting a friend and colleague of mine, a Superior Court judge from California, reacting to the Secretary of State's comments, she described the problem accurately. The solution was wrong. I think President Obama's remarks could be interpreted several different ways. I've had numerous reactions to comments that I made about it last week, and some saying, oh, cut the president some slack, give him a break. What he was saying, possibly, was that give me a break of all the issues that we're facing. An imploding economy, healthcare issues, energy, education. How could we even possibly think that marijuana is such a big issue? So he may, in fact, have been suggesting that the drug itself was not a big issue. I don't think that's how most people took it. I think most people took it as a dismissal of a very serious issue. There are millions and millions of people who are marijuana smokers today. They're not all stoners in the stereotypical sense of that word. Many of them smoke marijuana because they cannot tolerate opioids, and they are terminal cancer patients, for example, or people suffering debilitating, intractable pain. Many don't smoke the drug at all, but care very deeply about our civil liberties and believe that the course of the drug war has simply been wrong and misguided. And it's not a laughing matter. It is, in fact, something that needs to be taken seriously.
And Norm Stamper, could you talk about your own evolution on this issue? Obviously, as a veteran, a policeman, and then a police chief, you had to incarcerate at various times people who were involved, who were drug users, not just drug traffickers. And the evolution of your thinking on this issue.
My first epiphany was as a beat cop, a rookie beat cop. I had arrested a 19-year-old in his own home. In possession of marijuana, had him in the backseat of my police car. This was incidentally after having kicked in his door on the strength of having smelled what we described in those days in our police reports as burning green vegetable matter. And I had him hooked up, had him in the backseat of my Cage police car. I was driving him to jail, and it came to me. I could be doing real police work. I could be intervening in domestic violence situations. I could be looking for the suspect who was carrying away my beat with daytime residential burglaries. I could be doing something, in other words, to stop the kind of crime that hurts people, scares people, causes people to change the way they live. That was my first experience throughout my career, moving up through the ranks, moving ultimately from San Diego, where I spent 28 years in that police department, to Seattle. I sort of refined my views and began to speak out much more publicly about the harms of the drug war and about alternatives to that war.
Norm Stamper, what do you think should happen to the hundreds of thousands of drug offenders who are currently in jail?
Well, I think those who are in jail for nonviolent offenses should have their cases reviewed case by case. And I believe that given the fact that we had an explosion in the construction of jails and prisons, particularly during the 80s, we need to reserve those jail spaces, those cells, for people who are certifiably dangerous, those who have made it clear that they don't belong among the free in our society because they're simply too dangerous. And yet we have those tens of thousands of cells, hundreds of thousands of cells being occupied by nonviolent drug offenders. I would release those who, on a case-by-case basis, can reasonably be predicted not to cause problems for society. I think there's much more comprehensive drug policy reform that's necessary first.
And Norm Stamper, here in New York, the state legislature and the governor have, in the recent days, reached final agreement on ending, for the most part, the draconian Rockefeller drug laws. They are actually, as the press reports today are, that they've actually agreed, as part of the new budget, to close three state prisons. And clearly, there will be some resentencing of some of the former people who have been in jail on nonviolent drug offenses. Your sense of how the mandatory sentencing around drug offenses, particularly, have affected the racial disparities in our prison system on the issue of drugs?
Wildly disproportionate numbers of people of color, young people, poor people, have gone to jail and ultimately to prison behind this drug war for decades now. No one will convince me that racism and discrimination does not take place. How much of that is individual, how much of that is institutional or structural is something for others to argue. The bottom line is a whole lot of these people have been uprooted from their communities, detached from their families. They've lost employment. They've lost student loans. They've lost public housing. And they've lost their freedom. The Rockefeller laws, of course, as you describe them, I think have been seen by an awful lot of people as draconian. And when you stop and think about the huge numbers of people who have been in prison for nonviolent drug offenses, and most of those for simple possession of marijuana, it's just heartbreaking. I'd say it's about time. About time would have been decades ago, but literally back in the 70s. Mandatory minimums are institutionalized injustice, and it's so gratifying finally to see that they are becoming the relic that they should have been determined years ago.
Norm Stamper, I just wanted to wrap with a final question about what happened here 10 years ago. You know, it's very interesting to come back to Seattle now in 2009. It was, of course, the end of November in 1999 that the Battle of Seattle took place. You were the police chief here. It might surprise many people to hear the sort of trajectory you've gone on now, but I'm wondering about your reflections now 10 years later. I mean, at this time, 10 years later, the global economic meltdown, where the people in the streets 10 years ago were really taking on this issue of unbridled corporate power globalizing around the world. What are you thinking today about the reaction of Seattle 10 years ago?
Well, clearly, the battle in Seattle is my legacy. 1 week out of my 34 years defines me as a cop and as a police chief. And I can bemoan the unfairness of that, but it is true for many people. That's the only way they know me. And I made major mistakes leading up to that week and during that week. And all I can say is that I'm awfully sorry I didn't do certain things and that I did do other things. Most of that is contained in my book, and I'm grateful for your mention of that book. There is a chapter entitled Snookered in Seattle. Having said that, what was accomplished during that week was to put globalization and anti-globalization into our vocabulary and to put the whole issue on the map. I really strongly believe that the experience during that week framed a whole lot of issues that people didn't think about at all prior to that time. And I think, as you've described it, we're now reaping what we have sown in the form of unbridled globalization and unfettered free trade. And I think it's time for all of us in this country to, as we attempt to pull ourselves out of this global economic meltdown, to really take a look at what issues of social and economic justice mean within the context of globalization.
And Norm Stamper, what's been the reaction of your colleagues in law enforcement? I know there are many who support your view, but those who work side by side with you as you become more outspoken on this issue of reforming the marijuana laws?
Well, last week in Minnesota, before a state House committee, a committee that is considering medical marijuana, I was accused of disrespecting police officers. I quickly corrected that police chief who was wearing a yellow tie with the language "police lines do not cross." I apologized if I gave the impression, because I have the deepest respect for frontline police officers. They didn't make these laws. They are victims of the tension and the hostility that is associated with enforcing or prosecuting the drug war. So it's not our frontline cops that we need to be concerned about. The vast majority of police officers, I believe, would legalize marijuana today. They have varying views on the other drugs. Many officers, including police chiefs and sheriffs, have whispered their support to me. When I say, well, may I quote you? Their response is, what have you been smoking? No, you cannot do that. It's some have suggested that President Obama's dismissal of the marijuana issue last week in the online town hall meeting was done because it's the third rail. Well, we've made it that. Americans have, in fact, bought the propaganda of the drug war. We can't conceive of it as a public health issue. This whole issue of drug use and drug abuse and prevention and education and treatment, as well as enforcement. We need to rethink it. We need to have the courage, the will, and sort of the analytical take on the systemic implications that are associated with a drug war and recognize that there is a much better alternative out there. And I think a whole lot of cops understand it. Certainly the 10,000 members of law enforcement against prohibition get it.
Finally, Norm Stamper, though we said finally before, just back on that point, when you said you felt you made many mistakes 10 years ago, what did you feel was your major mistake at the time?
Not vetoing a decision to use chemical agents, also known as tear gas, against hundreds of nonviolent demonstrators. That was on the first morning of the major emergence, if you will, of the conflict, of the hostilities. I honestly believed at that time, and did for 5 years after my retirement, it was only on book tour and listening to a whole lot of people who were in that city at that time, that I concluded that there was an alternative to what we did. Just quickly, tactically speaking, we had a huge intersection, strategic intersection, through which aid cars and police officers and fire units could not travel if they were needed for any kind of a medical emergency, even unassociated with the World Trade Organization conference. And so the cop in me blessed that decision. Warning was given. It was announced repeatedly. I personally was present at the time. I walked to the far side of the crowd to make sure that the legal warning that was given through the bullhorn could be heard, that it was clear, that the ramifications of disobedience would be understood by all. And I blessed that decision, and as I said, for 5 years after, supported it. The chief in me, however, should have stepped in and said, yes, it is possible that a woman giving birth in an office building or a local hotel, somebody in cardiac arrest on the 27th floor of the Sheraton, would be difficult for us to reach. But what really are the odds of that happening? The cop in me said, doesn't matter what the odds are, we need to be available, we need to be ready. The chief in me should have said, for the greater good, we ought not to have brought those chemical agents out. We ought not to have, raised the stakes. I do not fault people at the scene. I fault myself.
Well, Norm Stamper, I want to thank you for being with us. He's written a book about his experiences as a top cop here in Seattle, the police chief during the Battle of Seattle, and now a spokesperson for the legalization of drugs, speaking to us via video stream from his home in the Orcas Islands. His book is called Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by a top health policy professor here at UW, University of Washington, about the healthcare crisis. Stay with us.
But it's an old song. I had to change it. Times ain't what they used to be. As I went walking down the superhighway, below the gray haze and sooted skyway, I was arrested for hitchhiking on the freeway. They said it don't belong to me. No, it ain't my land, and it ain't your land. Could be a rich land, but it's a poor land, 'cause of the few that hold it in their tight gripped hands, so that it don't belong to you or me. When I was younger and in my schooling, I learned and followed by all the rulings. I never dreamed that they were only fooling. How could my teacher?
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Seattle. Juan Gonzalez is in New York. And finally, as lawmakers continue to debate health care proposals, we take a look at how the economic crisis can impact the health of people in this country. I'm joined here in Seattle by Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He teaches at the University of Washington School of Public Health. He's written extensively on the impact of societal and economic inequalities on the health of a population. He argues combating inequality might be the best way to ensure improved health. Why is that, Dr. Bezruchka?
Basically, when you ask the question, do you want health or health care, Americans think that it's health care that produces health, when there really is very little evidence for that. What turns out to be really important is the nature of caring and sharing in society. And the best factor that really impacts that is the degree of inequality. Where societies are more unequal, people don't look out for one another, they look out for themselves. Where societies are more equal, and economic equality is the thing that is most important in this, people look after each other, society looks after each other, and pretty well everyone does better. There's almost nothing that is better in a society that tolerates the extreme levels of inequality in the United States. And so we end up dying younger than people in all the other rich countries, despite spending half the world's health care bill.
And Dr. Bezruchka, do you see any correlation between the growth of economic equality in the United States and the health of the people in general?
Yes, we used to be one of the healthiest countries in the world back in the 1950s, and now we are but as healthy as Cuba, and we've been strangling Cuba for the last 40 years. So as inequality has grown in this country, our health, though it's been improving, has not improved as fast as it has in all the other rich countries and quite a few poor ones as well. No expert really doubts that. That is, we die much younger. Even, you know, major government documents point that out. Most Americans, of course, are not aware of that. They don't realize that they push up daisies well before their time. That's the key issue, to make Americans realize that we need to fight for health rather than for health care. I've worked clinically as a doctor for 35 years. I'm not against providing health care services, but we need to understand that that is not what produces health in society. So we need to first make known the fact that we die younger than we should. Then we need to measure our health indicators relative to other countries, and instead of being what I 30th in what I call the Health Olympics, we should rise up and be in the top 10, perhaps. I mean, we win the most gold medals in most Olympic contests. If we had an event for health, we should be close to the top in the Health Olympics, and we don't even show up for the final event.
Dr. Bezruchka, how does our health care system affect this, influence this, and what is the system you think would improve the health of the most powerful country on Earth?
Well, if we talk of a health care system, first of all, we have to recognize health care is a very tiny factor in the health of whole populations, and that's a real polemic. What's really important is how we structure early life. Since half of our health as adults is somehow determined between conception and age 3, 4, or 5, early life lasts a lifetime, and we are the only rich country that doesn't have mandated paid maternity, paternity leave, as all the other rich countries do. So we neglect early life and we pay the price with poor health as adults. I think in terms of a health care system, a medical care system, I think we should remove the profit motive from it. As long as we have health care insurance companies that in 2005 made $100 billion in profit, it's very hard to tamper with that kind of an industry. However, profit care is not good for our health. So I would begin by taking profit out of the system and not seeing it as a market phenomenon.
And how do you think this can happen? Politically, President Obama has not come out for single payer, but we're going to have to leave this question for the next time we speak. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, for joining us, a professor at the University of Washington here in Seattle, as we wrap up our broadcast. A very special happy birthday, 90th birthday, to a close friend, to Irma Justina Weiss. Happy birthday, Irma. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Phil Duncan-Deuce, Aaron Mata, Angeli Kamich, Nicole Salazar, Steve Martinez, Hani Masood, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.